this with, I can get pretty emotional on a mediocre Buick commercial. And all of this is a little bit heavier than a rearview mirror camera and all-wheel drive. I don't know really where to start. I know Wednesday, well, I'll start with this. If Larry Ellis, here's your Larry Ellis hack. If Larry Ellis ever tells you something is not a big deal, it's usually a big deal. Of course, I knew that growing up with him coaching Becky and Angie softball. Then when I got the opportunity to coach him with the twin softball, we started softball practices in the middle of February. Nobody was practicing softball in the middle of February, and we were pretty good. And he would go, we would go to these games, and he would tell these other coaches that, well, you know, we do what we can. We're just plodding along. And then we would win 19-0. And I know what those other coaches were thinking was they've been sandbagged. Well, this was kind of the same thing. He really let this on like it wasn't a big deal. Of course, again, when he says something isn't a big deal, it usually is a big deal. They didn't, were not able to do the procedure as they hoped they would. And so they had to do it sort of the old-fashioned way. And then that didn't quite go exactly as planned either. And so we are where we are today. He's in a lot of pain. He just can't get comfortable no matter what he does. I think we're still wanting blood pressure to be a little bit better, I think. We're still waiting for the kidneys to do a little bit better. I think we keep saying about turning a corner. It's a very long corner. And I think we're kind of somewhere in the middle of that. But it's still just a very precarious situation that he's in. And I don't know. It's hard whether you undersell something or you oversell something. It's a very serious situation. And I don't know any other way of putting that except for it's just a very serious situation, and of course, prayers are extremely needed, I think, still, especially in this time. I think he would say that he would want everyone to attend worship and worship with their full heart towards God, and that's, of course, what we are going to attempt to do here this morning. We didn't even need those. Really thought I would. This morning we're going to continue these lessons here in John. Start here in John, the 9th chapter, and sort of do just a complete overview there of John chapter 9. When I started preparing this sermon, a lot of times preparing a sermon for me, I find out all kinds of things that I never intended to find out. I often call the internet my rabbit hole, and I chase a lot of rabbits down a lot of different holes. But I often like to find out why someone said what they did, or why was it translated the way that it was translated. And again, a lot of times going down those holes, it proves interesting stuff. I hope we accomplish that here this morning as well. In the days of Jesus, there was only one source of fresh water in Jerusalem, and it came from the spring of Gihon, and that was located just outside to the north of the city. The city has protected this spring by a set of towers. And about 800 years before Jesus was born, King Hezekiah decided they needed a more accessible way to get water into the city. And so he built a tunnel underneath the city streets, and it ran for about 1,700 feet from the spring of Gihon to the pool of Siloam. Now, the Pool of Siloam served many purposes for the people of Jerusalem. Of course, it supplied fresh drinking water, but it was also located in the poorer section of the town, and it was a place where the poor and the sick would often come to bathe. If you were a Gentile and you converted to Judaism, one of the requirements for making that conversion was to be baptized, and the Pool of Siloam was one of those places that was used for that. In addition to that, during the Feast of the Tabernacles, every morning for the first 7 days of the feast, a priest would come and take a golden vessel to the Pool of Siloam. He would fill it with water, and then he would bring it back to the altar amid the shouts of the people, and he would pour the water on the west side of the altar, while another priest would pour a drink offering of wine on the east side of the altar. And one other item that had to do with a comment that one scholar made was that when Herod the Great built or rebuilt the second temple, which is where Jesus did a lot of his ministry, he had designed a way to pump living water up from beneath the floor of the temple, where they could wash down the altar, the utensils, and the floor after the bloodiness of a day of sacrifice. I'm not sure, but I think it's logical that source of water would have come from the tunnels that Hezekiah had made as it made its way down to the Pool of Siloam. In addition to all of that, the Pool of Siloam was also referred to in that time as the Messiah's Pool. The Pool of Siloam was the place where Jesus sent the blind man to be healed of his blindness. There's another oddity about this healing that Jesus did for the blind man. Ordinarily, when Jesus healed someone, he would touch them or simply say, "You're healed." And of course, they would be healed. But this time was different. This time, the Bible tells us that Jesus spat into the dirt. He made a mud paste when he applied it to the man's eyes. And then he told the man to go and wash in the Pool of Siloam. Jesus sent no one else to the Pool of Siloam, only this one man. And of course, the question I ask is why? Well, at the beginning, when we started doing these lessons in John about the seven miracles or signs that Jesus did, I said that these signs were the same purposes that we use our road signs for. As you go down the road, you'll see a stop sign or a yield sign or a speed limit sign. And all of those signs are intended to get your attention, to tell you something that you need to know. Out of all the miracles that Jesus did in his earthly ministry, John focuses on these seven signs because there's something about each of these signs that has something that God wants us to see. God wants to get our attention. He wants us to know something about Jesus that we need to know. But what exactly is this sign trying to show us about Christ? Well, I think first that Jesus did this sign to make the bold declaration that he was the Messiah. One of the marks of the coming Messiah was that he would heal the blind. In Matthew 11, for example, John the Baptist was facing death. And he was beginning to have some real serious doubts about his ministry. And so he sends to Jesus to ask for proof that his death was not going to be in vain. And then Jesus sends back this message in Matthew 11, 4 and 5. He says to go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. But why was that important? Well, because Isaiah prophesied when God brought salvation to his people in Isaiah 35, verses 5 and 6, it says that the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, and then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. And later in Isaiah 42, 7, it says that the Messiah would open the eyes of those that are blind, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and from the prison those who sit in darkness. It was so obvious, really, that even the blind man could see this. And so he tells the Pharisees in John 9:32 that never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. And just in case maybe folks didn't catch the connection that Jesus was the Messiah because he heals a blind man, Jesus sends this blind man to the pool in that day known as the Messiah's Pool. Really, Jesus couldn't have got more obvious than this. And we'll just look at a couple of things here. The first thing here, the blind man never asked to be healed. Really, he was just sitting by the side of the road. John 9:1 tells us that as Jesus passed by, a man blind from birth. The blind man, again, is just sitting there, begging by the side of the road. We're not told that he asks or says anything to Jesus. He may not even know that Jesus is close at hand. He may not have even ever have heard of Jesus, but he's going to hear about Jesus now. In fact, when this man is healed, this man is going to be so excited about Jesus that the Pharisees can't seem to shut him up. When the Pharisees discover that this man has been healed of his blindness, they're furious that Jesus has healed him, again, because it was on the Sabbath. And so the Pharisees, they say to this blind man, "What do you say about him since he has opened your eyes?" And the man answers in John 9:17 that he is a prophet. That, of course, wasn't the answer they were wanting to hear. So for a second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. Now, we know that this man, Jesus, is a sinner." And again, the man answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, though I was blind, now I see." And they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And he answered here, "That I've told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" Well, I think, of course, that last comment by the healed man sounds like he was having a little bit of fun with them. He knows that the Pharisees hate Jesus, and he knows really that he's flirting with being thrown out of the synagogue, but that doesn't seem to matter to him. This blind man is so excited about Jesus that he doesn't care about any of that. He doesn't care what the Pharisees think. He doesn't care whatever they can do to him. As far as he's concerned, the only thing that matters is, "Once I was blind, but now I can see." And so that brings us to our second reason that Jesus probably sent this man to the Pool of Siloam. Jesus wanted to get the attention of the Pharisees, and there's no better way to get their attention than to send this man to the pool. Of course, Siloam means to be sent. Also, we see in the Old Testament numerous times when talking of the Messiah, the Messiah would be described as the sent one. This blind man here goes and is washed and he comes back seeing. And of course, the neighbors who had seen him before begging were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" And we find this in John chapter 9, verses 7 through 13. And just kind of paraphrasing that, and it said, some of them said, "It is he." And others said, "No, but he is like him." And some kept hearing the man say, "I am that man." And so they brought him to the Pharisees. Jesus here deliberately healed this man on the Sabbath. And just like we talked back in a few lessons ago, Jesus could have done this on any other day of the week, any day but the Sabbath. But it seems that Jesus here in John did most of his miracles on the Sabbath, maybe just to annoy the Pharisees a little bit. And of course, we need to keep in mind that Jesus didn't really like the Pharisees' attitude anyway. They were vain. They were self-righteous. They were self-centered. The only people that they seemed to care about, of course, is themselves. And so Jesus seems to take great pleasure in causing them a little bit of frustration. And it seems that Jesus did this every chance he got. But why would Christ do this? I think if you've ever watched a bullfight, have you ever noticed how the bullfighter takes those sharp sticks and he puts them into the bull? Well, why does he do that? Of course, he does that is to madden the bull, to make the bull angry enough to attack. And that is sort of, I think, what Jesus is doing here with the Pharisees. For 3 years, he's been tweaking them and taunting them this whole time. Jesus is setting these self-centered men up to fulfill prophecy. They're going to be the ones who bring about his crucifixion. They're the ones who prompt the crowd to shout, "Crucify him, crucify him." Because they're so furious at the time, they can't hardly see straight. Their role in this prophecy is critical. But they have to be angry enough to do exactly what God prophesied would happen hundreds before all of this. Of course, that wasn't the only reason why Jesus wanted to get the Pharisees' attention. Another reason that he wanted them to carefully examine this miracle. These men hated Jesus so much that they would do anything to discredit him. They call in the blind man two or three times, and eventually they call in his parents to testify too. And the end result is there was undeniable proof that this was a legitimate miracle. But the undeniable truth that this was a miracle didn't sway the Pharisees at all. They still rejected Jesus because since they couldn't discredit him, they still justified their rejections by saying, "We know this," or "We know that." In John 9:24, they say, "We know this man was a sinner." Well, why was he a sinner? Well, for them, he had healed someone on the Sabbath. In John 9:31, they say, "We know that God does not listen to sinners." In John 9:29, they say, "We know that God has spoken to Moses. But as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." In their minds, they have an excuse for not listening to Jesus. And it's because they know stuff. But do you remember how that blind man responded to that? He said, "One thing I do know, I was blind and now I see." And again, this man was blind, but the Pharisees were not, and their blindness was worse than his. Jesus said in John 9:39-41, he said that "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." And some of the Pharisees near him heard him say these things, and they said to him, "Are we also blind?" And Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." Being physically blind is hard, but being blind to God is far worse. You, of course, know you can have 20/20 vision and still not see things. I hope, like me, you've driven down the road and maybe not seen a stop sign or a stop light. I don't want to be the only one that's ever experienced that. Last year on a trip to downtown Tulsa, with Missy in the car, she let me know I ran a red light. Well, I didn't see that red light, and I could have said it was because of everything else I was looking at. But the thing was, I didn't see that sign right in front of me. And if you want to really aggravate Angie, ask her about the red light she ran in Dallas, because we about had a real breakdown there. But there, in the same way, there are people out there, like we don't see stoplights all the time, that don't see God. Like the Pharisees we have this morning. You know, he's right there in front of them, in their midst, but they don't want to see him. One writer put it this way. Some people can't find Jesus in the same way that a thief can't find a policeman. Well, they will do anything to avoid Jesus. I've read about a man who was recently baptized into Christ who admitted that before all of that, he would block people on social media who talked about Christ because he didn't want to hear what they had to say. I've worked with a lady who was reading a book, The Muscle and Shovel, and she was asking some questions, and I asked if I could come and visit with her and her husband, and that they never got back to me. They didn't want to really hear about God and church and stuff like that. So how do we reach people like that? How do we begin to break through people's barriers? And I think the true answer is that we don't. We allow God to do that. I think when I first started preaching at Kansas, I had the idea that you had to really be a great salesman. And so I began reading those kind of books and reading those kind of blogs that would tell you sort of those key phrases to try to convince people to buy into a message. And then one day a young lady came forward and she was baptized that I had spoke with several times. And she never returned back to church. And that bothered me. That bugged me. That shouldn't have happened. I felt like I had done everything right, and yet she never came back. And I think the more I thought about that, I realized that Jesus really didn't have a whole lot to do with that conversion. It was really that I had talked them into it. I hadn't left any room for Jesus to touch her life. And that, for me, was a hard lesson to learn. But we need to be reminded of what Jesus said in John 16:8, that when the Spirit would come, that He will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. We don't, as Christians, have to do any convicting of anyone. That is the Spirit's job. Well, if that's the Spirit's job, what am I supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? Well, I think it's the same thing that the blind man did. You and I are to tell people what Jesus did for us. And of course, that can become hard because there's a lot of people out there that don't want to hear about Jesus. But if you know what Jesus has done for you, it won't become a matter of intimidation. You'll talk about Jesus the same way you'll talk about anything that you love. And maybe if folks are bugged by it, it's because they can't shut you up. In closing this morning, Helen Keller was someone, of course, who was born both blind and deaf. But because of her courage and determination, she became a very famous woman. One day she had the privilege of being introduced to Mark Twain. And commentating on that day, she later said that I could feel the twinkle in his eye, in his handshake. Well, I think that's what the spiritually blind of this world need to sense from us. They need to feel that twinkle in our eyes and that joy in our hearts whenever they meet us. And like the blind man healed by Jesus, who was not afraid of intimidation, he looked folks straight in the eye and said, "I was blind, and now I see." This morning, if you are not a Christian, we encourage you to make that decision. Don't delay. Now is as good a time as any, and we encourage you to come as together we stand and we sing.